Well, hello, everybody. Jan Rutherford here with Self-Reliant Leadership. Thanks for joining us. And I know we had some technical difficulties. Many of you were expecting us to start almost an hour ago, and we had some glitches. And again, my apologies. I am sure it's my fault, so I take responsibility for that. Hey, I'm really excited to add to the discussion today my friend Kevin Eikenberry. Kevin, welcome.
Hi, Jan. Glad to be here.
How are you? How are you
fantastic.
This morning?
Thanks. I'm great.
Good.
It's good. Still morning for me for four more minutes.
Four more minutes. Yeah, it's 9 in the morning here in the Pacific Northwest. Typical fall day. Rainy, gloomy, chilly, but beautiful. You can't discount the beauty here.
There you go. Well, I'm not outside right now, clearly, but I don't think there's many clouds here, and it's probably seasonable. Probably gonna be about 60 degrees here today. Really a beautiful day.
Nice.
And I guess here is Indianapolis.
There you go.
Indianapolis today.
There you go. And I'm in the Pacific Northwest. And again, this is the second time I've had you on LinkedIn Live, which we now call Office Hours. You are the author of many books. A lot had to do with long distance learning, remote. You've got 9 courses, I think, on LinkedIn learning, leading at a distance, leading virtual meetings, management foundations, planning for your hybrid organization. Pretty relevant. Making key decisions as a manager, managing for results, and a few others. Super accomplished, obviously, and you do a whole bunch of events for a lot of people. You know, when you look at, you know, your life's work, what are you most proud of from a career and professional perspective?
What I'm most proud of is that, number one, I found my life's purpose, and number two, that I'm living it every day, and that number three, and they're all connected. So I'm not really giving you three answers, Jan. And the third part is I'm most proud of the fact that, quite honestly, every day I get the chance to help leaders get better, which is what I was put on this earth to do.
Yeah. Isn't that something that, boy, when I look at folks, I think, you know, do you have a job? Do you have a career? Do you have a calling? And boy, if you're lucky enough to be in that situation where you get to get up in the morning and say, I get to do things rather than I have to do things.
This was definitely on that list. I've been looking
That's
forward
awesome.
To this. I've been looking forward to being on the other side of the mic, because a lot of the times I'm on your side of the mic. I mean, I get interviewed, or I'm the guest often as well, but I was really looking forward to this conversation.
Well, you do these, you know, let me tee this up first. We're calling this a career survival, you know, because we want to move people from just surviving in their career to actually thriving. We know there's a lot of friction right now between employers and employees. You and I hear about all the problems and the challenges all day long. That's the work we do. You've also been involved in a lot of events where you've organized and brought in experts, subject matter experts and leadership gurus and all that. So I kind of wanted to, the reason
like
I
you.
Selfishly, like me,
like
but
you.
Selfishly, I wanted to hear what you've learned from all of this. And I wanted to tee it up really from an employee perspective and an employer. But before we do, you know, you just had an event recently. You probably had about 9 or 12 guests on, something like that.
Actually, we had 40 guests.
40?
Over Holy 5 God. Days. Yeah, we were live about 8 hours a day for 5 straight days. And we had 40 people, for those of you that are watching, like smart people like Jan. That joined us over the course of 5 days. Yep.
So again, we'll get into this, but I'm just wondering, this is probably impossible, but of those 40, I mean, were there a couple themes that stood out or, you know, go ahead.
Yeah. I thought you were going to give me a name. I'm like, I am not going to do that.
No, I wouldn't do that to you.
But, I mean, yeah, there were definitely themes I think that came out throughout. And I think there were themes about the importance of us as leaders to take care of ourselves and our own sort of mental fitness, if you will. That certainly was one of the areas. But I would say if you forced me to pick an overall theme, and we did have guest experts from around the world. I mean, certainly from many, several countries. And we had, it was sort of serendipitous, right? Because we invited all these people to join us, and then they picked their time slots based on their calendars. And I was just talking with the project manager of that project, the Virtual LeaderCon is what we call it, virtualleadercon.com. And I think the biggest overall takeaway is that, to my words now, to be a better leader, we must be a better human, which means that the line between personal and professional development as a leader is very, very slim, if there even is one. And I think that maybe the overall biggest lesson was that as we work on ourselves, we become better leaders, and along that same line, that the skills that help us be better leaders help us in every other area of our lives as well. Mm.
Yeah, that's interesting because, you know, we interviewed the former CEO of Aetna. His name escapes me right now, but he structured his book similar to the way I did mine: leading self, leading others, leading the organization. Not particularly novel, but one of the things he said was, when you're leading the organization at the highest level, what you really realize is it's all about leading yourself.
And yet it's not about us at all. Like, the best leaders recognize that. Right. And yet, I mean, we talk about what we call the 3-0 model of leadership, which is that leadership is about outcomes, others, and ourselves. And yep. We can't take ourselves out of that. And yet, it's not about us at all. So it's like that duality of, I realize that it ultimately is a reflection on me, and yet it's not about me at all. If I make it about me, we'll mess up big time. Right?
Yep. Yeah. I think it's spot on. And, you know, I've had more than a few conversations just this week with folks that said, I've really got to take care of myself physically, mentally, emotionally, or I'm not going to be anything for my team. And, when I start coaching someone, a lot of times we'll talk about their professional goals and what they want to do with their company. And oftentimes there's like, well, I'd love for you to hold me accountable to my diet, my exercise. I'm like, well, I'm not that kind of coach, but I'm glad to remind you.
But I can ask you those questions. I mean, I can ask those questions. Holding someone accountable often is simply saying, are you doing it? How are you doing in that area? Yeah. Are you staying with your own commitments to yourself, right? I am not neither a diet coach nor a fitness coach. And yet we can both ask those questions. And you know what, everybody, you don't have to hire Jan to do that. You can get anyone to be an accountability coach for you.
Yep, that's right. Well, right. Let me shift gears a little bit. And I want to talk about, just yesterday there in the news was a big walkout at Netflix. It seems every day in the news, employees are voicing up what they want, what they need, what they desire. And a couple of days ago in Inc. magazine, there was an article, "Want to Keep Your People from Quitting? A new study taps into what employees are now expecting from their companies. Remote work options, 71%. High number of PTO days, 70%. Transparency about salary benchmarks, 68%. Investment in upskilling, 60%. And last one, a higher title, 58%. So
I hadn't heard any of that data at all until you just said it. And none of it surprises me. And other than the first two, those have been the same for a long time.
Yeah.
People want to be developed. I mean, you can use whatever word you want to use, right? People want to be developed. They want to know where they stand, and they would love a title. But really what they, I think more than the other two, is they want the skills, right? So the reality, but those other two are just about recognition. The first two are new-ish, although the number one valued perk pre-pandemic was the option to work remotely some of the time and or have more flexibility in our work, which is really those first two, Jan. And so I think that while we need to hear that, when you recognize that, I think it's also important to recognize it's not all earth shattering or all new. And if it's really new to you, then take heed, but recognize that the whole world hasn't changed because of that five things on that list, right? If that makes sense.
Yeah. And somebody asked me to share the article, which I just did. And, you know, Kevin, it really parallels Dan Pink's work from a few years ago where he said, you know, we want three things. We want autonomy. Again, that's been highlighted with the, in, during the pandemic. We want purpose and meaning, which I think people are trying to develop that on their own in addition to their company. And the last thing you hit on really strongly is upskilling, reskilling, development, mastery, whatever that might be. People want to grow. And so, you know, and for the most part, other than, you know, higher salaries, most of those things don't cost any money. What they require, and I'm interested in your opinion on this, is it seems they require leaders to trust their people.
Well, to listen to their people, to trust their people, and to serve their people. I would say all three of those things, you know, and those don't cost any money. There might be some other costs to us as leaders, right? Internally, but there aren't any economic, you know, nothing that the accountants are going to be able to measure. That's for sure. You know, I want to sort of reflect on something else that you said, and that is, you know, that people are looking for that purpose. Mm-hmm. I wrote here on LinkedIn just earlier this week in my newsletter, Remarkable Results, about my take on the Great Resignation. Mm-hmm. And so a couple of thoughts about it, if you don't mind.
It's a great article. Go ahead.
It parallels. So the first, well, that means at least one person read it, Jan. So thank you. So I think that there's a couple of big ideas there. Is there a Great Resignation? Yes, the Labor Department data says there is. All that stuff is true. We don't need to go through all that. But I think that oftentimes leaders end up saying, oh my gosh, we've got this Great Resignation. Oh my gosh, what's going on? Mm-hmm. I wish this wasn't happening. And I would say to you that just because there's a overall trend doesn't mean it has to impact you and your organization. So the question then is, what are we going to do about it? And I think the underlying cause of the Great Resignation, and it relates to those first two, to all of our conversations so far, is that I think what's happened because of a pandemic and people having time and their worlds being different and all that stuff, is that the Great Resignation is caused by the Great Reflection. And the Great Reflection is, what do I really want from work? Am I really getting from work what I want to get? Is it possible that I could have something different? All of that are those reflective questions that people are asking, which are leading them to say, I'm going to leave. Now, that's always been the case when for individuals. But what I'm saying, the trend here is that more people are doing it. So now, if I'm an individual leader and I'm seeing this resignation or I'm worried that it might come to me, then what I need to do is what we've already said. I've got to stop and I've got to listen and understand what my people want and need and see what I can do to provide that for them. Because quite honestly, if people are doing that reflection, that's positive for everybody. Because if at the end of the day, someone says, Jan, I don't want to be in healthcare anymore, right? I want to be in something else entirely. Well, then if I'm in healthcare, and even though I might really value that person and that employee and that team member, the reality is if that's really what is true for them, then it's not serving them or us for them to still be here.
Yeah. Right? I think that's really keen insight, you know, especially on the reflecting. As you know, one of the things that we ask when we're coaching people that's sometimes the hardest question to answer is, what do you want? And I think that's what people are really struggling with these days, is they realize now more than ever, we really do, most of us, thankfully, have a lot of different options. And I think, you know, it's interesting when I'm out in the wilderness on expeditions with guides always bring up the time and money issue. They're like, you know, isn't it funny that people work their tail off to come out here and spend a week with me and spend all kinds of money? And then they think I'm the luckiest guy in the world. I come out here every day. I have no money, you know, as a guide. And it's and they're very cognizant that they've made that trade. They're like, you value money. You know, you executives is how they see it. And we value time in the wilderness. And it's interesting because that is always something that comes up out there is, am I spending enough time with my family? You know, is my career on track? What's really important in life? I mean, all those existential questions, they seem to come up.
No, I'm not surprised by that at all. Yeah. I have not had, the good fortune of being on one of your expeditions, but that doesn't surprise me in the least.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, again, in the press, I think the employees' opinion on what they want is, and again, in my opinion, is pretty well represented. I don't think there's as very much ambiguity about what employees want. I don't know that the employers and the leaders are always listening. But I think conversely, I don't know that employers are very clear about what they want from their employees. You know, the assumption is always efficiency and productivity. You know, put your head down, get your work done. But I think it's a lot more nuanced than that. And I'm interested in your thoughts on, you know, again, working with lots of leaders and lots of different organizations. What do you think the leaders want from the employees? Because I don't hear any of the employees necessarily saying, well, here's what I want. Hey, and by the way, bosses, you know, what is it that you want? The one thing, not, you know, that's essential.
It's really interesting that this is a topic that comes up today for lots of reasons. The first thing I'll say is this: there's lots of research that says that the skills that executives or leaders are looking for aren't around productivity, right? Mm. Or efficiency, but are around collaboration, innovation, creativity, problem solving, which are outside of that box. Now, maybe some of those to help us get those efficiencies and those revenue and all that other stuff. But the reality is that and of course we're talking globally right now, right? So that if that's what team members think that leaders want, they might not be correct. Just like, so we could flip the coin around from what you were saying. As leaders, we need to listen. As team members, we need to listen. One of the things, Jan, that I tell leaders all the time, listen, your folks, it is not in their job description to read your mind. Mm-hmm. And so we have to be clear as leaders, as team leaders. I'm not even talking about organizationally now. I'm just talking about leading your team, wherever you are, frontline leader, in the middle, somewhere, doesn't matter. That if, because everything you just said to me is about expectations, right? What right. is expected? What does success look like? How will we know if we're doing it well? Because I believe that 95% of people, 95% of the time, want to do good work. And good work is defined by what those expectations are. And I think you're exactly right. There are many, many, I'm more convinced of this than ever, many, many, many leaders that aren't very good at setting clear expectations.
Yeah.
They're just not. And I will often ask a leader and say, so what is it? So, okay, I'll get sort of granular now. So yeah. I've got a team member that's not doing very well. I've got the one. I just need to fix, Kevin, help me fix the one.
Yep.
And so my first question always is, so what do you expect of them? Well, you know, well, no, I don't. And guess what? Neither do they. Right. And if they don't know, how can they possibly deliver? It's not possible. Luck, I suppose. Not a good strategy. Luck. Yeah. Right.
Well, that's where the leaders, I think we humans, I should say, make lots of assumptions about the clarity of our expectations. And I say the same thing. Three things. When somebody's complaining about a problem child, I'll say, do they absolutely know the expectation? Do they know where they stand with you?
In relation to those expectations.
And do they know the consequences for meeting, exceeding, or not meeting expectations?
And we can't get to the second two if we don't have the first one. Like, we got to get the first one. Like, I was with a group yesterday, a long-term client. I was with a group yesterday of largely, 40 people, 41 people. All females, which is a whole other part of the story. But there were only like three supervisors or four people in a supervisory or leadership role. The rest of the folks in the room were team members, right? And we had a whole conversation about expectations yesterday, about expectations across the team and up with the boss. So the whole point of I walked them through this mental exercise of how does it feel when you really know what's expected? It feels really good. Like, I'm confident. There's all this good stuff that happens as a result. And so my conversation to them and with leaders all the time is, it's not just were the expectations shared, but were they understood? The goal is mutually understood expectations. And for us as leaders, not only sharing what we want and need from them, but what they want and need from us, which is where we started the conversation. Right. Yeah. So we started this whole conversation.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, since leaders are human and humans are fallible, and you know, you and I both agree that most leaders aren't good at providing expectations and make all kinds of assumptions, is it imperative for the employee to take some personal responsibility in making sure that they know what the expectations are and that they derive the clarity from their working relationship with their boss?
It's only imperative if you want to be successful. Like, I don't know if I use the word imperative, but the thing is, so here's the thing. If it's not clear, we have two choices. We can either, and by the way, everyone here who's a leader, you all have a boss too, right? So I'm still talking to you. I just have your team member hat on, not your leader hat on, right? So you have two choices if the expectations of you are not clear. One choice is to lament the fact that they're not clear. Blame the boss because they're not clear. The other option is to ask.
Yeah,
I know which choice I'd make. I know which choice I would encourage you to make. I mean, you can choose to be a victim or you can choose to be a victor. Which do you want to be?
Yeah. Well, and you know, the other part I'm going to ask you about, you know, for maybe some advice, because I hear this a lot, especially from senior executives, not junior, not mid-level. They'll say, you know, every single day I'm getting little notes from the boss, the CEO or whomever, and I'm literally fire drill. I mean, these are the big rocks I need to move, and every single day things get prioritized. And from my seat, it's easy to say, well, why don't you push back and say to the boss, you know, hey, if I follow up on all these things, these big things aren't going to get done. Is that okay with you? And so what happens is, you know, the first step is, well, the person gets really better at delegating, and then he's creating the same problem for his subordinates. Any advice there?
But I mean, let me just stop you right there, because I think if we're really effective delegators, we know that the minute we do that, we're shifting the priorities of those folks. So I believe to be a highly effective delegator, part of that delegation, which, oh, by the way, could be the upskilling part that people are wanting, right? But part of that delegation should be, where does this fit in the priorities? Because you're right. Otherwise, it automatically becomes the number one thing.
Yep.
And we may not want it to be the number one thing.
Yeah. But,
and some of those notes that we're getting from the CEO, right? They may not realize, they are unaware that they have now become your number one thing. They might not even have wanted it to be the number one thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It kind of reminds me of my friend when he became, long time ago, he became the battalion executive officer in Korea. He was walking down the hallway day one, and he goes, God, this carpet's ugly. Next day he goes to the office and they're ripping out the carpet. And he's like, I didn't want him to rip out the carpet. He didn't realize.
I got 100 of those stories, right? And so I would say this to anyone at any level. Is it okay to ask those questions? Yes. The higher you go at people go as a leader, the more insulated they are, the more they really want to know what's going on. Yeah. That's why some of them went on a television show and put on a wig or a mustache and tried to become undercover, because they wanted to know what was really going on. Most of them, and Jan and I aren't speaking, we don't know the specifics of the personality of your boss or the, you know, or the political nature of it. But I would say that the odds are in your favor that if you will ask those questions, they will be happy to help you sort it out and might have been blissfully unaware that was even a problem.
Yeah. Let me throw, Ray has been very patient. He was on it an hour early. And do you know Ray?
I don't. Hi, Ray.
So he's asking, how does a well-educated leader communicate to a person with no education? So in other words, how would a doctor communicate effectively with a ditch digger? One cannot understand the other, correct? They cannot effectively communicate with each other. We see this all the time, Kevin.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Go.
So, Ray, I say this with love and respect, that if we say that they can't communicate with each other, we're starting from the wrong spot. Of course they can communicate with each other. Right. It's if I'm the doctor, I'll use that example. Right. And I'm going to communicate with the ditch digger. I've got to think about my audience. To be an effective communicator, I have to always think about my audience. So might there be things in the way that might make it harder? Sure. Does that mean we cannot? I don't buy that. And in fact, if we believe that, it's like a fait accompli. We're never going to get there. So it's like if I've been doing something for a long, forget the education piece for a second. Like I've been doing something for a long time and I want to coach someone who's never done it before, back to this delegation idea. I've got to remember what it was like to be the beginner. Because when I remember that, I'm a better communicator and coach, right? The perspective of having done it 50 times, but recognizing the perspective of the person who's not done it ever. So the same thing here. Can a well-educated leader communicate with a person with less education? Of course, but they can't communicate from where they're at. They have to move to the place. And I don't mean level, and none of that means intellect.
Right.
Right. And I think that's another thing that people, and I'm not saying that Ray's messing that up, but people mess that up. Like, well, they're smarter. So, and by the way, the person, the ditch digger, just to use that example, might be intimidated by the doctor. And so, you know, if we were neighbors and didn't know what each other did, we'd have no trouble communicating. So we just need to remember that. And if I'm the more educated leader, I've got to recognize that my job isn't to send messages. My job is to get messages received. So I have to think differently about what I'm communicating, how I'm communicating it, the examples that I use, the language that I use.
Yep.
And it isn't about dumbing down. It's not about intellect. It's about finding common ground.
Yeah. Well, again, my simple perspective, you know, from a leader perspective is, I sometimes I'll hear leaders say, I need to communicate better. I need to, you know, find the right words, the right analogy, the right metaphor, the right story. And often I say, you know what you need to do to communicate better? You know, you need to ask better questions. It's not about your message. I mean, people support what they help create. So I think in some ways, that's not an easy problem to fix, but a simpler problem to diagnose. What I see oftentimes with employees trying to influence up, I think that's harder. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on people really understanding the leader's point of view. Because I know as a former CEO, I had the best intentions. I didn't always match my words and deeds. And there was times I had this fantasy. I'm like, I wish people, you know, would be considerate of me. Like, I wish, you know, I'm giving you everything and you're not making my job easier. I wish you would just try to have my point of view once in a while. I don't know if other CEOs share that perspective, but what are your thoughts on influencing from, you know, more from the middle up when we see policies we don't like, behaviors we don't like, direction and strategy we think is incorrect? All those different things. And, you know, rather than, you know, get it in a picket line and go out on strike, how do we affect, you know, productive change internally?
I think that, there's a lot in there. So let me just try to be simple and succinct. Number one is, if we don't know we have to recognize that leader has a perspective that we don't have. Right. They have information. They have a view. They have a view. They have a perspective that we don't have. And if we want to influence anyone else, we need to better understand their perspective. But by definition, right? If I'm trying to sell you a car, I need to understand what your perspective is if I'm going to get you to buy that car. Right. So if I want to influence up. If I want to influence anyone, I need to understand their perspective, which means it goes back to what you said a minute ago, Jan. Questions. Lead with questions. So I have some concerns about the policy. I'd really like to understand what was underneath the policy. What was the purpose of doing it? Now, notice what I asked fundamentally was the why question. But if I go into the boss and say, why did you set that policy? That's a bad way to do it, right? Even though that's ultimately what you're trying to understand. So I think asking more questions, recognizing, assume positive intent, right? It may not always be there, but assume, if we start from assuming positive intent, and if you just can't quite get there, because Kevin, you don't have my boss. Like if you can't quite get there, you can at least assume neutral, benign intent, right? Don't assume that they're trying to overpower, overwhelm, and, you know, force us to comply, but rather that their intention, that they have a perspective we don't have. And if we had their perspective, we might've made the same decision they made, but they don't have ours. So they might adjust it when they understand ours. So I think it starts with it's in many ways, it's the same thing that Ray was asking.
Yeah.
About, right? How I can influence others, including up, by working to understand their perspective, understand their goals, understand what's important to them. And from that place, then I can influence. And all of that starts with questions. And, but the other part of that about going up, right, is there's this positional difference. And you've got to be aware of the positional political difference. Don't check your brain at the door, but don't let that keep you from being proactive.
Yeah. I think you could hit on a couple of key things. I think one, you know, is the power of the question on both sides. And, you know, Stephen Covey wrote a long time ago, seek first to understand. Mm-hmm. That, boy, if you're trying to influence someone, you're trying to get a point across, it's hard to do that if you really don't understand where the other person's coming from, like you said, positive intent.
And back to saying, assumptions, right? We make assumptions about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, and you said, I mean, why is a dangerous word sometimes? And, you know, it's like, why did you do that? You know, people's flight or fight goes right up. But if we said, you know, hey, Kevin, you know, what are you hoping the outcome would be of this particular policy? You know, walk me through, you know, how you came to some of the conclusions that you reached. I had a really interesting conversation with somebody struggling to do something with regarding policy with vaccines. And I'm not going to get into the which side or blah, 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 but it was really interesting, you know, to have that discussion with somebody. And, you know, I think both of us really tried, as we're talking through this, really tried to see both sides. And again, we both obviously have opinions on that. We're human. We do. But it was real interesting to basically, before the discussion began, and we didn't say this overtly, but we decided to hold our views lightly. You know, we decided. And we had what I thought was a really productive discussion as part of the decision-making process that the organization had to do on some, you know, very obviously controversial things. And it was just really interesting. I actually gave myself a pat on the back a little bit, because it was like, you know, it's really helpful to understand, you know, some other perspectives that you might really not agree with or understand. But then when you see where they're coming from, it's like, oh, now I know how to, you know, I know not how to make a counter argument, but the questions I might ask that would lead you to, you know, making, you know, raising questions on your own. I don't know if you've had any of those.
Yeah. I was thinking about, so I always, to your point, I always tell people to be careful of the naked why, right? The why question in that way. So I'll give you a way to help you with the why, another way to get at why, mm-hmm. and another way to get at other people's perspective. And so it's a three word front end to a conversation starter, which is help me understand. Help me understand your perspective. Help me understand that decision. Help me understand what led to that decision. Help me understand how you feel. Help me understand is, to me, it's been very powerful for me as a way to get into conversation, to understand the other person's perspective, and to, at least for me, to remind me that I'm in exploration mode, not influencing mode yet. Maybe I'm going to get to the place I can influence. I'm not trying to influence now. I'm trying to understand so that I can determine how I would want to influence, negotiate, persuade, whatever other words you might put in front of that in terms of that next step, right? Sell, whatever that word might be. So, and I'm not saying those are all the same, but I think this front end is important to all of them, because we can't get there with someone else until we know where they're at.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We titled this Redefining Success, a Career Survival Guide, because we're trying to help people survive, not just survive, but thrive. And a lot of people are redefining what success really looks like. And I think the, you know, some of the themes that we're talking about here is really, you know, one thing every organization has in common is there's humans in it. Yes. And with humans, I mean, there's going to be conflict and difficulty and misaligned expectations. I mean, that's just the way of the world. And what you're offering up is basically, you know, you have the tools, you just got to put them in your toolkit. And that those tools are really the questions that you're seeking to understand others, that you're not going in as a bull in a china shop and just trying to get your way. And that requires, you know, a little bit of finesse and a little bit of patience, which sometimes, you know, we don't have.
So let me put another frame around what you just said and what we've really in many ways been saying the whole time, Jan, and that is that I ask leaders this all the time. Do you want compliance or do you want commitment?
Yep, me too. I ask that as well.
And some people say, well, I want both. I'm like, okay, but do you only want compliance? And the answer is no, I don't. Now, so flip that around. I'm not in the leadership role. I'm influencing up or whatever. Yeah. Do you want them to just comply or just say, yeah, Jan, that's okay. Go do what we want to do. Or do you really want a new commitment? And the only way we get there is if we go there together.
Yeah.
Only way we can go
there. Yep. Let me throw up another question here. Bala Kumar, when should I limit conversations with bad bosses who think they are evaluating our job for promotion, end up taking advantage of our status, playing with EQ?
Well, I'm going to channel my inner Mary Abajay. And if you all don't know who Mary Abajay is, do you know Mary?
I don't know Mary.
Mary has done, I think, one LinkedIn learning course. She wrote a book called Managing Up. She'd be a great person. I'd be happy to connect you with her, yeah. But I'm sure any of you should check out Mary. I'd encourage you to do that. But let me say this, that what she would say is it depends on what bad looks like. If this bad boss is truly toxic, if they're unethical, if there's some of those things, then maybe the right thing for you to do is to leave. Right. I think we have to recognize that. So I don't know about limiting conversations with bad bosses. I think it depends on what bad means, what that means in this, in a particular case. Right. And then, you know, do I want to limit conversation or do I want to limit the impact that they're having on me in terms of how I'm feeling or how I'm doing or all that? And so, and there's a lot we could unpack there, but I would say, when would you limit it? I think you'd limit it if you feel like that boss's behavior is unethical, unlawful, truly toxic to you or to your customers. That's what that's probably be my short answer. Yeah. And there's how can I influence my boss? There is, how can I work with my boss given that I know they're a human and maybe we're not quite on the same page. And then there's, is this the boss I should be working for?
Yeah. Well, and again, part of it, the nuance is, you know, is this person going to leave soon, get promoted? You know, how long is this environment?
Well, yeah, and then, you know, do I want to wait them out, right?
Yeah, because I always say, you know, and ultimately we always have three choices. We, you know, we can deal with it, just deal with it. We can try to change and influence things, and we can always leave if we don't feel our values are aligned. Like you said, and I always say, do the second thing before you leave. At least try to change it, because you're going to go somewhere else and there's going to be difficulties there as well. And I always say to folks, are you running from something or running to? And how have you really developed your influence skills?
Oh, that's so good. And let me add one more part to that. And that is that if you've had four of those bad bosses in a row, maybe you need to look in the mirror.
Mm. Yep.
Maybe it's not them. Maybe it's you.
Yeah.
You're the common denominator at that point.
This is, I love this question from Victoria. Cause I always say to folks, you know, you can't manage everybody the same, but the whole team has to feel that you're fair. And that's the art. So, you know, her question, Kevin, how would you answer that? How do you deal with a boss that has favorites? That, and again, that's her perception, that he or she has favorites.
Yeah, I think first of all, that implies that my guess is, and tell me, Victoria, if I'm wrong, that I hear in that the boss has favorites and I'm not one of them. That's the first thing. So I'm going to go on that assumption until you tell me otherwise, right? So I guess I would say, I would ask you several questions, or anyone who would ask that. It's like, what leads you to that assumption? How is that a problem for you? Or why is that a problem for you? And if the answer to the first one is, or answer to the second one is, yeah, that's a problem for me. Then the third one would be like, what is it that leads, if being a favorite is important to me for whatever reason, okay, we're cordial, so that's a good thing, right? Like, then the question would be, so maybe I need to let that go. And like, okay, so they had a previous relationship with that person. They know that person better. They've worked with them longer or whatever. But the next thing would be is, what could I do? I'm just going to use the same language. What could I do to become one of those favorites? In other words, is there something that boss is looking for from their folks that I'm not delivering? Right?
Yeah.
Recent promotions given shows that. Okay, so from my perspective, I'm Victoria now. From my perspective, man, I was more deserving of that than the other person. Maybe, maybe not. So this is takes us right back to where we started. Mm. Clear expectations, right? I'm not going to go to, I wouldn't suggest going to the boss and say, why did you promote them instead of me? I would go to the boss and say, hey, I want to be successful here. What are the expectations? How am I doing? What could I be doing differently or better that might help lead me to advance?
Look at this. You're gifted there, Kevin. You helped her.
You're welcome.
Well, you know, one thing, I mean, to kind of frame this a little bit is there's a guy named James Clausen. It was the professor at the Darden School at University of Virginia. And I used this book with my MBA students for many years. And the big concept that stood out for the students of all the things in his great book was VABE. V-A-B-E. V-A-B-E. And it was values, assumptions, beliefs, and expectations. And his big point was, when you don't understand those in other people, you're going to get sideways. And there's also a guy named Peter Senge who wrote The Fifth Discipline and a whole book on systems thinking. And he had this thing called the ladder of inference that was for advocating or inquiry. And it basically is the same way to figure out what's somebody's train of thought and how did they get to the point where they have beliefs and how does that inform what they pay attention to? But, you know, again, from a simple perspective, if we listen, we ask questions, we listen for values, you know, what people hold dear, the assumptions they make, the beliefs they have, and the expectations, I think we get a lot further along. Have you heard of that concept before?
No, but Kevin? I love it. You saw me with my head down. It's because I was writing it down. I talk about all four of those things, but not in that way. I think that's really powerful. And to connect it to the ladder of inference, which is, you know, I started to smile when you said Peter Senge's Fifth Discipline. There was a time, it was a long time ago, because Jan and I are both older, but that was the hot book. I mean, it was the hot book.
It was
Fifth Discipline. And I always said to people, I said, so if I wish everyone that bought it would read it, because, which is probably true for all books, but man, there's an awful lot of people that had it on their shelf, a whole lot of people that didn't really read very far into it. And if you only took that one thing from it, it would be incredibly valuable for people.
Yeah.
To think about it. I don't think
it's a hard book. It's a hard book to read. And I'll tell you,
it is a hard book to read.
I've taught it. I've taught, you know, parts of the feedback loops. And I'll tell you, it goes to show my limitations. Of all the things that I've taught, I think teaching system thinking is the hardest thing I've tried to teach other people. It's it's really hard, at least for me. But there's some great stuff in there. And like you said, I think probably the best part for what we're talking about today is understanding the ladder of inference. And you can Google that and find all kinds of different takes on it and pictures of it. Ladder of inference.
Yeah. Highly recommend that you think about that. And it's valuable on two levels. It's valuable on the level of thinking about how other people climb the ladder. But I usually talk about is how am I climbing the ladder? Where am I? When I look at someone else's behavior, I look at someone else's performance, I look at a comment someone made to me, how far up that ladder am I climbing in terms of, oh my gosh, right? I believe this about them. I have decided this about them when all they did was ask a question, right? Like what really happened? Like what did the videotape show is different than where I'm how far up that ladder I'm climbing. And a lot of times as a coach, what I'm doing is trying to pull people back down the ladder. Okay, what really happened here? What did the videotape show? Right, let's start there, right?
Well, you know, the other interesting thing, you know, when I'm coaching, oftentimes someone will say, well, I'm sure, you know, this is what's going to happen. Like, that's an assumption, you know.
How are you so sure of that?
That's an assumption. I'm like, well, how do we eliminate that assumption? Oh, I need to ask a question. I mean, like, bing, bing, bing. When we ask people about, you know, how do you know what motivates people? Like, ask them. You know, if you don't ask them, you're gonna derive everything that you think about their motivation, their drivers, based on assumptions. Unless you ask them, you get to know them, you care about them. You know, so I think that's a big theme of what we talked about today is eliminating those by really trying to understand other people. I think, you know, the other thing I wanted to touch on before we go a little bit is, you know, the whole thing of trust comes up all the time. And oftentimes, you know, we'll say, you know, simply, hey, it's doing what you say you're going to do. But I like to phrase it as my co-host on the podcast always says, is keeping promises. And, you know, if we really want to have trusting relationships, we need to be careful about making promises and commitments. And because when we do, we have to keep them. And so oftentimes, you know, my friend Jim, in a meeting, he'll just keep a track of the notes and he'll just keep track of the promises. And at the end of the meeting, he'll say, okay, Bob, you made 10 promises. Sue, you made 3. Is that realistic? And then they'll go, oh, I can't do all that. Okay, good. Cause I don't want you to make promises you can't keep. And even with salespeople recently that are having supply chain issues with customers, we're like, okay, you can't make a promise. You're going to get them parts and supplies, but you can promise that you'll call them on Tuesday at 2:33 PM Eastern time. You can make that promise. You can follow up. So let's make promises we can keep with each other. What do you think?
Which takes us back to clear expectations, right? So let's say, and this is always true, but it's there's more barriers in the way to us when we work remotely from each other. But like, let's say that Jan and I, for all of the rest of you, Jan and I are colleagues, right? Jan asks me to do something. It's fully within the realm of the work and all that stuff. And I say, yeah. And I say, yeah, I can do that. And you say, yeah, I need it by Tuesday. Cool. And Jan, I deliver it to you at 5 p.m. We'll even assume we're in the same time zone, right? Which we are, you and I are not. But let's just assume that I deliver it to you at 5 p.m. on Tuesday afternoon. In my head, I met the commitment. Did I meet the commitment from your perspective? Maybe. A lot of times when I ask that question, people say, well, I really wanted it by noon. I was going to work on it today. Didn't they know? Like that. So the point is that when we set clear expectations or have a clear picture of 2:33 Eastern time, not only do we have a better chance of delivering from our perspective, but we know that when we do it, we've delivered from their perspective. Because here's the thing. If I think I delivered, I think I built trust. But from your perspective, maybe I didn't eradicate it, but I heard it. But I'm blissfully unaware of that, man. I'm delivering. And my trust, the trust that Jim has in me is dropping a little or a lot. And I'm not even aware of that, which is a big problem. So I think that, you know, the clearer we are the easier it is. Now there's the, I made too many promises and I said, I'm going to deliver, have 3 phone calls at 2:33 PM. That's a different issue. But like the clearer we make them, the better chance we have of delivering both from our perspective and theirs. Because how much someone trusts me isn't based on my intent. It's based on their belief about me and how it came. They're deciding, not me.
Kevin, I want to pay you a compliment. I think I figured out why you're so successful. You know, we've talked a number of times, but I think I finally figured out why you're so successful. When you get a question, you don't just answer it at face value. You really listen for what's behind the question, and you break it down, and you look for the assumptions in the question. I mean, there's a lot that goes on when you're answering a question. And when you're asking a question, and I think, you know, if those of you watching, I mean, you know, play it back and watch how, when Kevin was asked a question, how he would, you know, really make sure he understood the question, that he was on it. I think that's a skill, a fine skill you've developed.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, we're coming to the end of our chat together. This flew by. You know, to kind of recap, we talked about what we think, you know, the employees want from their employers, what the employers need from people. We ended up really talking about, you know, what happens, you know, between people. You know, that's work. That's corporate America, the world, the business. It's what happens between people. And we talked about ways that we can reduce the friction. You know, a certain amount of friction is traction. A certain amount of friction is drag. You know, sometimes friction is good and sometimes friction, you know, is not so good. As you look at what we talked about, what do you think are the takeaways, you know, that you'd like people to understand for, you know, as they redefine success and move from surviving to thriving in their career?
Well, I'll say something that we talked about and something that we didn't, and maybe the something that we didn't can be a way to close. I mean, you hinted at it, but I'll make a comment. I think that the biggest thing that we talked about today, without ever using these two words, is servant leadership. Mm. And, you know, that's a phrase that I love and yet feels redundant to me, because I don't think there's any way to lead without being a servant. And I know that there's a lot, because that phrase is out there, there's baggage, positive and negative, around that phrase. But I think underneath all of this conversation was, how do I lead as the leader? How do I lead as the follower? And all of it's been about better understanding others as the front end to getting greater success for ourselves. So there's the first thing I would say. That to me is a way to sort of, put an umbrella over some of the things that we talked about, Jan. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that I just feel like we should say is that doing this work as a leader is hard. Like, it's hard. It's lonely sometimes. It's isolating sometimes. It's hard. And doing it in the time of a pandemic, what I call adding the COVID layer on top of it, makes it even harder and more complex. And so I would say to you that self-care isn't selfish. Mm. If we want to give our best to our teams and give our best to our organizations and thrive in our careers, we can't do that we can't give our best if we're not at our best. We can't give anything close to our best if we're not at our best. And so that's a whole nother show, probably with a different guest.
Yeah.
But self-care isn't selfish. We have to take care of ourselves.
Yeah.
So that we can be at our best, but also so we can model for others that we want them to do it too. Because they won't if we aren't.
You just defined better than I ever have what I mean by self-reliant leadership, that you've got to be squared away, you know, so as you can be reliable to others and be there. So you know, Kevin, I appreciate you greatly. You always, you always send the nicest notes. You even sent an old fashioned note the other day I got in the mail and thanking me for something, which is gentlemanly and kind. And I always, it always makes me smile. I know it's your signature trade, part of your brand, but you tell people that they're remarkable. And it's just, it kind of goes back to all the schools of positivity out there. It's not just something you say. I know you mean it when you tell people that they're remarkable. And, what you've done, on LinkedIn and for so many leaders is so impactful. And I'm truly grateful for the contribution you've made to our collective learning. And I just appreciate you. You're remarkable.
Thank you. I have, we've never met. That day will physically met. That day will come. And we've had the chance to interact in this way, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 times now. Probably 4 or 5 times, like with others watching us, like this. And I have grown to appreciate you so much, and the unique perspective and the way that you bring your passion for your work into the world is making a huge difference. So it's a pleasure to be with you. Mutual Admiration Society. We'll leave it there.
Yeah. Well, thanks. And I'll throw a couple of other comments up here just real quick. Tricia, thank you for that. I appreciate that. And another comment from Victoria. Let me see if I can get this name right. Maybe it's Nikita. Again, thank you all for watching and listening. And feel free to reach out to me and Kevin on LinkedIn. And again, Kevin's got 9 or so courses out there on LinkedIn Learning. They're all great. He's got a bunch of books. So if you're not familiar with his work, definitely look him up. And our next session will be November 11th. We're going to have 4 senior NCOs who recently retired from the military, now doing great things in the business and nonprofit world. What we would call a genuine American heroes. Look for that November 11th, Veterans Day in the United States. And with that, we'll sign off. Again, Kevin, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks, everybody.